So first, let me remind you that if we were to test or to try to investigate extensions of general relativity in the infrared sector, things would be very easy because we have data. We have supernovae, standard candles, we have the CMB, we have baryonic acoustic oscillations, we have weak lensing, and we don't have any fundamental theoretical problem. I mean, general relativity is happy with its infrared limit. We just have a little experimental problem, which is the acceleration of the universe, and whatever your preferred model, either a simple cosmological constant or something more complicated, it can be modeled by effective terms within the Friedmann equations, and you can compare your model with data. You can make a kind of Taylor expansion of the scale factor of the universe. This is the existence of the universe. This has been known forever. This is a great discovery of the beginning of the 20th century, namely the expansion of the universe. This is a great discovery of the end of the 20th century, namely the acceleration of the universe. This has not yet been measured. And once this will be measured, it will be very easy to distinguish between different dark energy models. Unfortunately, at this quantum gravity conference, we are interested in the UV limit of general relativity. And here, of course, things are much more complicated just because we basically don't have any data at all at the Planck scale. But we have a theoretical problem. We have singularities and everything that goes with them. So I would just like to mention that things might be changing now. We have all seen this very nice map from the Planck satellite released a few months ago. But those of you who are not cosmologists might have missed this very nice plot, which is in one of the 50 papers released by the Planck collaboration. And on this very nice plot, you have informations of the state of the universe at the onset of inflation. So this is the universe 400,000 years after the Big Bang. But this is the universe a fraction of a billionth of a second after the Big Bang. And why are we allowed to exclude some models of inflation with these data? Just for a very simple reason. I've written here the Friedmann equation, not in the standard way, but in a reverse engineer way. This is the content of the universe as a function of the evolution of the Hubble parameter. And if we can trace back the evolution of H, then you can reconstruct the potential of the inflated field. And why can we do this? Precisely because there is a slight tilt in the spectrum. It is one of the parameters of this plot. And this slight tilt is precisely due to the variation of the Hubble parameter during inflation. So maybe data about what we are interested in are now showing up. So the line of thought chosen in this talk are the following. I think, and we will all agree on this, that at this stage, a testing loop quantum gravity or any model of quantum gravity is extremely difficult. I think that the point raised by Ivan Aguio, Ashtekar, and Nelson in the previous talk are extremely important and exciting, in my opinion. However, as a cosmologist, I believe that now it is mandatory to explore all the possible paths, and this is obviously a very exciting one. But I think it's too early to choose between different approaches. So my view is now to not to choose a specific scheme or even to require full consistency with the mother theory, because I think at this stage it is basically impossible. So I will not choose between the different school of thought that are known within the LQG or LQC community. I will even not pick up a single effective theory. I will just try to explore as many possible probes as possible. Finding one would already be extremely difficult and extremely successful. And of course, I will focus on what has been done in my group and with my colleagues since the Madrid conference. So let me begin by a very fast reminder on what has been done in the past. Basically, in effective loop quantum cosmology, we have two main corrections, the holonomy corrections, which comes from the fact that there is no operator associated with the Ashtekar connection, but it stayed with its holonomy, and the inverse volume correction, which comes from the fact that there is zero in the spectrum of the triad operator, and therefore when you deal with its inverse, you have to implement a trick so that the theory remains consistent. As a first attempt, it is interesting to investigate the propagation of gravitational waves in a standard background, non-LQC background, just so as to understand what are the different effects due to holonomy and inverse volume terms. This is, for example, the effective energy and potential seen by a gravitational wave under holonomy and inverse volume corrections. Of course, they are different, and it means in the cosmological vocabulary that the potential seen by the Schrödinger equation of your wave is not the same, and therefore the parametric amplification does not happen in the same way, and this will lead to antagonist for the holonomy and inverse volume case modification of the primordial power spectrum. You can even play the game to add up both corrections simultaneously and to calculate analytically the infrared and ultraviolet limits of the resulting spectrum. However, at this stage, it is of course still a toy model. So if we want to be serious, we of course have to also open up the quantum corrections for the background itself. And then we are back to the well-known now view of the inflationary stage of LQC. So basically, as explained many times before with Klein-Gordon equation, during the contraction, the Hubble parameter is negative, so this is anti-friction, the field oscillates more and more, and just after the bounce, the Hubble parameter is positive, so this is friction, and you are led to standard inflationary evolution. So I will come back to that later, but as already explained for different reasons by many other people before, inflation is a kind of prediction of LQC. But the other way around, it is also possible to use inflation to try to probe LQC. And the reason for this is basically the following. The blue line is the evolution of the horizon, the universe as a function of time. So this is the bounce. H is vanishing, so the horizon is infinite. And this is a given length scale in the universe. And the important point, without going into the details, is that obviously, depending on the value of this length scale, the history is completely different. The number of time you cross the horizon, the time when you cross the horizon is completely changing, and this is why we can hope to have potentially strong effects on the primordial power spectrum. Once we have a spectrum, we can propagate it in time and compute a C of L spectrum, so this is really the observable, but be careful, here I am dealing with B modes, so this is not what the Planck satellite has been measuring up to now, okay, this is the tensor modes. And then you can perform a kind of Fisher analysis to understand the kind of which parameter space can really be probed with current or forthcoming data. In addition, we now have a very, very well-controlled mathematical understanding of the situation. So we have very good approximations for the pre-bounce, bounce, and post-bounce phases. So at the semi-classical level, everything is under control. However, we face a very big problem that has been known now for a few years, which is the problem of the algebra closure issue at the effective level. The problem is that when we add up those modifications to the constraints to account effectively for the quantum effects, we end up with an algebra which is not closed anymore, which means that the vector of evolutions are not anymore parallel to the submanifolds of constraints. And therefore, something has to be done. And what is done is to add up counter terms. So I will focus on vector modes for pedagogical reasons, because they are easier to understand. So let me first write down the three smeared constraints, Gauss, diffeomorphism, and scalar constraints. And just by writing down the evolution of the Hamiltonian, you can see that this Poisson bracket should vanish. So this immediately requires that the algebra should have this shape, so the Poisson bracket between constraints should be proportional to one constraint. However, this is not the case when you add up the holonomy corrections with the effective quantum constraints. So we have the extra terms that are called anomalies. So to remove anomalies, we have to add up counter terms that vanish at the classical limit. So let me define the variables. We have the A and E variables, K bar and P bar that are the background variables, delta A and delta E that are the variations. Basically, if you want, K bar is associated with the Hubble parameter and P bar is associated with the scale factor. And we perform the standard replacement of the K bar variable by this function, where mu bar basically tells you something about the scale at which quantum gravity becomes important, and where this integer n is let free, because when k bar appears not because of the curvature of the Hasse-Eckhart connection, then there is no fundamental reason to fix n equal 1. Also, I'd like to mention that usually in cosmology, vector modes are neglected because they are known to decay very fast. But keep in mind that everything is decaying very fast in an expanding universe, is increasing very fast in a contracting universe. And therefore, at the bounds, of course, they could play a role. So you write down the smeared constraint up to the required order. So we have these k functions that are the corrections due to holonomy. And then you add up those possible counter terms, alpha 1 and alpha 2, that might account for the possible anomalies. You do this for the scalar and diffeomorphism constraints. And then you write down all the Poisson brackets to try to figure out what your algebra looks like. So far, so good for the first two ones. Here we have this term, which is proportional to one constraint, so this is nice. Unfortunately, we have this extra term, which obviously is a non-very nice-looking anomaly. So the way to get rid of this situation is basically the following. At first, we try to solve solve this situation by tuning this free integer n. And this can be done, but we have two problems. You have infinitely many solutions that are leading to different phenomenologies. And in addition, you can do it only up to the fourth order in k-bar. And this is a problem, because you would like something non-perturbative here. You would like really to be able to go through the bound. So the important point is that everything changes when you add up matter. So you just have to deal with the content of the universe, not only the gravitational sector. And once you have written your constraints for the gravity part, for the matter part, and computed the full Poisson brackets, so this is the quantum corrected constraints for gravity plus matter, then by some kind of magics, everything goes well. Which means that not only the algebra can be closed, but it can be closed in a nearly unique way. Unique here, I don't mean in a real mathematical meaning, but under some reasonable assumptions on the shape of the counter terms, you find a unique, easy solution. Once you've got this solution, then you are happy because you can make calculations, you can go through the phenomenology. In particular, you can write down the evolution for the background, the k-bar and p-bar dot evolutions, and you can also write down the evolution for the gauge invariant perturbations living in this background. However, as a cosmologist, of course, I would prefer to compute something that is already measured, or at least that can be measured easily. So it's better to focus on scalar modes. So scalar modes are a bit trickier to handle than vector modes. However, we now know how to do this. So basically, the procedure is the same. You begin with your background, you define your main variables, you replace the functions by the pseudo-periodic function, and you keep as many free parameters as you can so as to avoid choosing a specific refinement scheme. So this is the holonomy corrected Hamiltonian constraints. So I just show you big formula not to impress, because nobody here will be impressed, and this is not very interesting. Just to show you that we begin with something which is not very user friendly. I mean, we don't like to see some expressions. But at the end of the day, you will see that the result is simple. This is just why I am trying showing you the different steps of the calculation. So this is a quantum corrected Hamiltonian constraints up to second order with many corrections and many possible counter terms. The diffeomorphism constraints, and then you compute the Poisson bracket. So I've just written here the easiest one. The other ones are much worse, but this can be done. You include matter, because we have learned from the vector sector that matter should be added so as really to close the algebra in a consistent way. So you have to write down your second order varied Hamiltonian constraints, and you compute the full Poisson brackets between the matter plus gravity part, including everything that you need. And the result is not very nice. You have 13 anomaly terms. Each of them is quite bad looking, and your theory is ill-defined. Fortunately, when you try to now ask yourself what you can do with the available counter terms, you can do precisely what you want. You can find a solution, which means that you can set to zero all the anomalies, and once again, in a nearly unique way. And when you look at the counter terms, they are not that bad. I mean, they are quite simple. And even more impressively, if you look at the resulting algebra, and this is in fact what you are interested in, this is what you care of, the algebra is very simple. It is very simple, and basically everything is encoded in this single omega function. And omega is just 1 minus 2 rho over rho c, where rho c is the density at the bounds, so if you want something of the order of the Planck density. So basically, we end up with something which is very tractable and which can be used to make calculations. I would like to mention that even if the algebra is anomaly-free, it doesn't mean, of course, and I think this is obvious from my previous equations, but it doesn't mean that we end up with a standard general relativistic algebra, of course. We still have a fundamental modification of the structure of space-time, and this is why something can be something exciting or something different can be expected at the phenomenological level that I will describe later. So as usual, and as before, once we have this, we can compute the equations of motions for the background and for the perturbations. So don't be afraid by the not very nice shape of those equations. I mean, in standard cosmology, you know that we don't like very much the Hamiltonian formalism, just for this reason. Basically, this is not due to LQC. This is just due to this kind of formalism, which is not the best suited one to study cosmological perturbations. Well, now, at the intuitive level, something important is happening there. Because let's go back to this omega function, which now enters the game. This omega function, I told you, is 1 minus rho over rho c over 2. It means that it goes to 1 in the classical limit, when rho equals 0. But it goes to minus 1 at the bounds. And it goes to 0 at all the critical density. But the important point is that when you look at the algebra, this omega function enters as a signature of your metric. So it basically means that the metric seen by our fluctuations is Euclidean around the bounds. So let me be clear. I would not like to push this too far. I am aware that this is a very effective approach. So I will never claim that we demonstrate or that we prove that the universe is Euclidean around the bounds. I just say that at the effective level, using this kind of approach, we effectively end up with an Euclidean universe around the bounds. And this is something exciting because you know that in cosmology, people several decades ago, have assumed that the universe was Euclidean for basically no fundamental reason at all, just because it helps stabilizing the path integrals. So it would be very nice, even yet it is not yet demonstrated, it would be very nice if a specific quantum gravity model can lead to this as a prediction and not just as a desire, as a hope. So let me make now a brief point about a long story. You know, in cosmology, we always have this gauge issue. I mean, we always, in any kind of gravity approach, we have a gauge issue. In cosmology, it is very simple. The gauge issue in cosmology is the following. As soon as you allow perturbations with respect to homogeneity, you have infinitely many time slicing with respect to which the perturbations remain small. So you have no preferred time slicing. So this is a well-known problem. Either you make a gauge fixing, but we all know that this is extremely dangerous if you don't do it in an extremely rigorous way, or you go through the heavy machinery of Bardeen potentials and Mukhanov variables. So with Thomas Kaito, we have derived a kind of systematic method to handle the problem of deriving gauge invariant variables in the framework of LQC. So you don't care about the details, but this is just something available. And as this is available, we can use it. And we can use it to compute the equation of motions of the perturbations, taking into account the previously mentioned corrections. So we have all the material to compute a spectrum and therefore to compute observables. However, I would like before to make a little point. We recently understood that there is a little consistency issue here. Many people, including myself, began by working with tensor modes because they are easier to handle. From the quantum gravity point, the algebra is automatically closed, which is nice. And from the general relativistic point, they are automatically gauge invariant, so this is nice also. So everybody begins with tensor modes. However, our tensor, vector, and scalar modes live in the same theory, in the very same theory. And in fact, what we discovered is that the corrections that had to be implemented for scalar modes should also be taken into account for vector modes. I mean, when you write down the perturbations, here, the only part where the different mode appears is here. This is psi and a for scalars, this is fi and fa for vectors, and this is hia for tensors. But they live in the same theory. And if you write down the equation in the correct way, you understand that the modification of the algebra that was performed for the scalars, because that's the most general kind of perturbations, is also influencing the tensor modes. So therefore, this kind of equation that I've shown you before for scalar modes should also be taken into account for tensor modes. So now let me come back to the phenomenology of tensor mode in this fully consistent way. Once again, let me be clear, I don't mean that this approach is fully consistent with the model theory. It is not. It is clear that we have tons of approximations. I mean that it is in itself consistent with something in coming from the model theory. So this is the equation of motions of our modes. So Linda Linzer-Forsch found a very nice trick to regularize this kind of equation here in the Fourier space. The blue line is the omega term, plus one in the classical limit, minus one at the bounds, zero around the bounds, and the red curve is a derivative. And then we are led to a very, very easy system of differential equations. And this is really the evolution in time of the Fourier, of the tensor Fourier modes we are considering with the classical amplification. And then we can compute a real spectrum, and this is the real fully consistent spectrum. So you can show and demonstrate analytically that the infrared limit is scale invariant, so nearly equivalent to general relativity. Nearly equivalent, not exactly equivalent, that the ultraviolet limit is exponentially divergent, and that in between we have interesting structure with kind of oscillations that are basically due to resonances in the effective Schrödinger equation seen by the modes. So don't be afraid by the divergence. Anyway, in this kind of approach, we have a natural UV cutoff, so there is no catastrophic behavior here. So once we have the spectrum, you can wonder, of course, how to measure the spectrum. And basically, the results are there. I mean, the idea that we performed with Boris Bollier is the following. Depending on the number of folds of the inflationary and post-inflationary phase, as explained Ivan before, the observable window will either fall here. And here, you cannot distinguish our model and JR. Fall here, and this is excluded by current data, or fall here, and then we have interesting stuff to study. So I took as three parameters the mass of the inflaton field and the reheating temperature. Depending on the values, either this is already excluded, or this is indistinguishable from JR, or we are in this band where some subtle effects with respect to JR can be expected and can be probed in the future. Okay, up to now, I have propagated modes through the bounds. But I told you that the bounds is Euclidean here. So it's a bit risky, isn't it? Because I don't even know what is a wave with an Euclidean metric. In fact, I don't even know what time is with an Euclidean metric. So it's a bit risky to do it that way. So one can also deal with a very different strategy, but still with the very same theory. Okay, this is the same theory. But now let us take a completely different point of view. We can assume that there is no meaning propagating through the bounds. And most probably, the right surface where to put initial conditions is the asymptotic silence surface. By asymptotic silence, I mean the surface where we have causal disconnections of the space point. This is exactly the surface where my omega function goes to zero. This is something, of course, that was anticipated in the classical theory by the BKL conjecture. And it is rather nice that here we have a quantum theory that proves one part, say, of the BKL conjecture, at least with the assumptions that I have given below. So what happens if we take seriously this idea that on this surface, if you want, the speed of light goes to zero, and we have really the connections of the different space points. Then the good point is that it's a very natural place to put initial conditions. So this is our usual algebra, and this S term here goes to zero, so we are back to Lie algebra, and this is something that seems to happen also in other models of quantum gravity, either causal dynamical triangulations or over Lipschitz gravity. So it could be very nice that this state of asymptotic silence is to some extent general to quantum gravity approaches. So let me take a 15-second pure speculation. If those ideas are correct, then this is very reminiscent, of course, of a symmetry breaking. This would mean that the fundamental state of space-time at extremely high energies is fundamentally Euclidean. This is what we have when rho is greater than rho c over 2. And then one could speculate that this Euclidean phase undergoes symmetry breaking to our usual Lorentzian phase, and with possibly different time rows in different patches of the universe. And one could wonder if the Goldstone bosons associated with this symmetry breaking could not be associated with the scalar field we need for inflation to happen. I have absolutely no proof of what I've just said now, so I close the speculative parenthesis and I come back to reasonable calculations. So why are we happy with this asymptotic silence? Because we know what are the reasonable initial conditions there. Initial conditions are such white noise. You have points that cannot speak one to the other. So you put a white noise spectrum, and we have calculated the evolution of the spectrum. Usually in cosmology, we know the evolution of the modes. But here I have written not the evolution of the modes, but the evolution of the spectrum itself, because we know how to put initial conditions not on the modes, but on the spectrum. And we end up with this kind of figure. This is the scale factor of the universe, and this is the physical length. And you know that depending on the history, when you take a given physical length in the universe, when you go backward in time, either it will cross this asymptotic silent surface, and we put initial conditions here, or because it's too small, or because inflation was too long, it will cross this transplancian surface, and we'll put initial conditions here. It is possible that we can deal with transplancian modes, but to be completely honest, I don't feel easy with this, and I prefer to put initial conditions there. So if we put initial conditions at the transplancian surface, then it's very easy to end up with a final scale invariant spectrum. This part of the spectrum here is just because we look just after they leave the surface, but after some time, this spectrum will be naturally scale invariant. So this has been known for long in cosmology, and this is not a loop quantum cosmology result. If we put the initial conditions at the other surface, at the silent surface, then one can show that it is possible to end up with a scale invariant spectrum even without inflation, and this is really a quantum gravity effect, but this requires a quite high level of fine-tuning in the equation of state of the barotropic fluid that you assume as the main content of the universe. So far I have told you basically about holonomic corrections, but we also have possibly inverse volume corrections in cosmology. And up to now, algebras were considered independently. So this morning on archive, we put with Thomas Kaito and Linda Linzerforce a paper which tries to close the full algebra, including holonomy and inverse volume terms. So in a few words about this technical work, we have shown that the inverse volume approach that was very well studied by those people can be generalized by adding nonlinear effects. We have shown that in the holonomy case, some solutions were missed in previous works, so they also can be to some extent generalized. And we have shown that when both are included together, we can find solution. We now have a kind of a clear picture of what the algebra looks like. However, we don't yet have enough to make experimental or observable calculations, because everything depends on a fundamental function for which we need some input from the model theory. So we have shown that the inverse volume correction has to depend on the holonomy one, and we have shown on which way this has to happen. However, consistency cannot tell everything. Consistency tells you a lot, but you need a bit more input from the model theory to really conclude on this approach. Now, I'd like to take another path. A path that was underlined by Ashtekar and many others at the previous loop conference and that I like very much, which is to investigate further indirect probes, because it will be very hard to really have a smoking gun of loop gravity in the CMB or anywhere. So what we mean by indirect probes is the following. All those plots gives you the evolution of the fraction of potential energy as a function of time, the field, if you want. It's proportional to the field. This is a field as a function of time. This is small deflation and big inflation. No deflation and big inflation. Big deflation and small inflation, and so on and so forth. All those plots are solutions of the effective LQC equations. All are possible. But no, all are not equally possible. And this is really, I think, the important point raised by Linda Linzerforce and others and my colleagues, which is that let's now take this bounce image seriously. There are very good arguments, very convincing arguments given by Ubai and others that the bounce is the correct time where to put initial conditions. But on the other hand, if we really take causality seriously, I mean, the bounce is not the initial time, by definition. There is something before. And before, you are in Minkowski space. This is much more under control. You are in a classical space. You are in a classical space which is before the bounds. So what happens if you put initial conditions there? In fact, you just have an oscillating field. You have an harmonic oscillator. What is the natural variable with respect to which you have a flat density distribution. This is a phase. Let's take the phase of the harmonic oscillator as a random, flat distributed variable. And the very important result is that the fraction of kinetic energy at the potential energy at the bounds, which could be anything between 0 and 1, is in fact highly peaked because of the non-linearity of the dependence upon this delta parameter. Delta can be not everything between 0 and 2 pi. And you see that when delta varies between 0 and 2 pi, XB is nearly always between 3 and 4, 10 to the minus 6. So it is very highly peaked. Let me say it another way. This is the 5 only? No. Really? Okay, that's a nightmare. This is the remote past. This is the bounds. This is remote future, okay? The universe begins here, follow one path to the bounds, and then goes back to this point. All the trajectories that you see here, so as to make points equally spaced at the bounds, are extremely highly fine-tuned, because they have to leave here at a very precise moment. This is a zoom of what happens here in the remote past. All the trajectories that you see here are basically one single trajectory in the past. But now, if you take in the past, equally spaced, as far as angles are concerned, trajectories, you see that at the bounds, they are not anymore uniformly distributed. They are extremely highly peaked at several points, you see? And this is what I show here. The probability distribution function of X is peaked at 3 point times 10 to the minus 6. And the number of e-folds of inflation is a function of X, which means that the number of e-folds of inflation is also a prediction of the model. This is something that I am not aware of for any other model in cosmology. And n could be anything a priori, between 0 and infinity. And we find that it is between 100 and 180. And data tells us that it should be greater than 70. So far, so good, I mean. In addition, you can use this to put an upper limit on the Emir-Z parameter, just because if the Emir-Z parameter is too big, the density at the bounds is too small, and you don't have enough e-folds of inflation. So gamma smaller than 10 is not very competitive when compared with the black hole value, but we know now that this black hole value can be questioned, so maybe this limit is quite meaningful. I have 4 minutes to tell you that, of course, we should also take into account anisotropies. And the reason for this is very well known, is because anisotropies are growing during the contracting phase, and therefore the shear is extremely important at the bounds. This has been studied by many people in the past. There are tons of fascinating articles on anisotropies in the LQC. The point we wanted to make here with Linda is the following. You can recast, this is Bianchi 1, only 3-directional scale factors. You can recast everything in a single modified Friedmann equation that I think was missed up to now. And thanks to this modified Friedmann equation, you can study to the details, the dynamics of the universe around the bounds with anisotropies. This, everybody knows, this is a directional scale factor. The universe is contracting, then it is expanding, and all the directional Hubble parameter goes to its very same behavior because we add inflation and everything goes well. Nothing new. What is new is this plot. This plot is a difference between two small h values. The small h is a mathematical function that goes to the directional scale factor in the classical limit. The only important point is that this plane is infinite. It is finite here because of the finite size of the screen, but it is infinite. The white areas are forbidden. The gray areas are authorized. But the problem is that on this infinite plane, only this one has the correct classical behavior. All the universes that live here or here or here have behaviors like this. It oscillates on a few Planck times. So only this one is correct. So in my opinion, this is another argument to put initial conditions before the bounds. Because if we put conditions at the bounds, we have infinitely many more universes that do not look like our universe. Okay. However, this does not solve the problem. Because if we put initial conditions before the bounds, then we should wonder, what is a natural initial shear? And I have no idea about this. And I think that nobody has no idea about this, because this is a very, very subtle question, of course, related with the usual major problem of cosmology. I have 1 minute to conclude with black holes. Well, black holes are, of course, extraordinary objects. From the viewpoint of phenomenology, they are not the best, just because we need small black holes to see strong quantum effects, and we have never seen a single small black hole. So let's assume that for some reason, we are able to create or to observe a very small black hole. Then with Jacobo and other people, we try to understand if the description of black holes in loop quantum gravity, which is very clear and very well under control, can be used to distinguish between the Hawking evaporation of this black hole and the loop quantum gravity evaporation of this black hole. So basically, the idea is the following. We took into account the subtle gray body factors and so on and so forth, and we studied the spectra. So this is a standard integrated over time endpoint Hawking spectrum, and this is the spectrum that you expect in loop quantum gravity just because you have discrete value of the areas. Okay, so you have lines. And then you take into account the smearing induced by any detector, and depending on the energy resolution of your detector and depending on the number of black holes you observe, you can distinguish, you can make a Kolmogorov test, Kolmogorov-Smirnov test, and distinguish between those models and see that, of course, for a good enough accuracy, you can go to the number of sigma you want. So basically, you end up with a kind of spectroscopy of the quantum black holes with the different energy levels and the associated probabilities. So of course, if we can observe this, it is quite easy to distinguish between the standard case. Also, if the pseudo-periodic structure of the area that we observe for small black holes remain true for larger black holes, which I don't believe to be true, but we can make this hypothesis, then it could be also possible to see this kind of effect with astrophysical black holes, still, of course, evaporating, otherwise you see nothing, not for the same reason as previously, not because of the discrete structure of the area, but because of this smooth features within the area spectrum. And the reason for this is that primordial black holes in astrophysics, if they exist at all, are probably caused by phase transition, and therefore they are all produced at the same mass. And this is why all the emitted quanta are adding up one with the other. Okay, so I finish. I have finished, in fact. I would just like to tell you a very, very brief little story. Not long ago, I gave a talk in a theoretical physics lab, and a guy at the end told me, oh, this is very interesting. So you have predictions for the CMB, so if in 10 years, the next generation of experiment disprove what you predict, LQG is dead, right? And I said, no, honestly, no. Only a very, very specific version of effective holonomy corrected LQC is maybe dead. So the guy laughs and say, okay, so this is exactly as in string theory. LQG is unfalsifiable. So I would like to make 2 points. First, I don't feel offended being compared with a string scientist. But more seriously, I think that this is not true in principle. I think that this is not true. But at this stage, it is not far from being true. So my wish for the future is that maybe we give up with very, very detailed and refined calculations, and we try really to identify universal effects that we all agree on. I mean, I would trade without problem a very refined calculations with heavy hypotheses to an order of magnitudes without any hypothesis, but coming from the model theory. And at this stage, this is exactly what we are missing. I think the previous talk was a very, very important step in this direction. So I encourage you that are strong loop quantum gravitists to think about universal effects, and I will compute for you with my colleagues the observables that are associated with this. Thank you.
Questions?
Hi, thanks for this very nice review. I have a question that goes back, in fact, since we talk about observations, to what Neil was saying. So we have this new Planck data, right, which is essentially telling us that we witness, you know, very weak non-Gaussianity. So somehow it's telling us that whatever it is, it seems to be featureless. So I want to know how much, I mean, you didn't talk about non-Gaussianity, and maybe you're not there, but let's say at some physical level, I would expect, an high physical story would be, if there is some kind of structure at the initial time, and there's a bounce, etc. I would naively expect that this would enhance the source of non-Gaussianity, but, you know, maybe that's wrong, so what's your take on that? On what is it going to be the direction of prediction?
Yeah. Okay, you're right. I think this is unquestionably a good path. It has been already slightly studied in LQC, but only with very, in my opinion, basic approaches. So it should be pushed further. In fact, I know quite a lot of people who have their hands in the CMB. and they see non-Gaussianity every day, but they know that they are instrumental non-Gaussianity. Every little problem in your instrument, every teeny problem in your instrument creates non-Gaussianity. So in fact, when you really talk with people that are measuring the CMB, of course, they can put limits, no question about this. But there are so many sources of non-Gaussianity. And in fact, as nearly any model beyond GR will anyway predict non-Gaussianity, I think that it is not a very good path to try to probe a specific model. But the other way around, it's true that if your model predicts non-Gaussianity and you observe no non-Gaussianity, then this is good to kill the model. It's true that up to now it has not been studied really into the details. But I mean, we face a kind of no-go theorem, because Planck data are explained so well by JR. There is nearly no place for improvement. You can nearly not decrease the chi-square. So what can you do? Either you predict a deviation, and whatever is the deviation, your model is excluded, to some extent, of course, or you try to predict the very same thing as a standard model so as to feed the data, but then you cannot say that you have really a smoking gun in favor of your model. So this is why the approach of indirect probes pushed by Bai and other seems to me to some extent more convincing, because it's true that inflation is non-natural at all in standard JR. I mean, triggering inflation is a nightmare in JR, and here, I mean, we can't do without inflation. In fact, this is even our problem. The reason why it's hard to test our spectra is that inflation is too long in our model. I don't know how to make an inflation small enough in LQC so as to be able to probe what I compute. So I think this is a good point, but that's not a proof.
Last question.
Just, I very much wholeheartedly agree with your last transparency here. I think that's what we need. But in the middle of the talk, you said that, well, these effects, like the signature change and so on, it is not coming from the full quantum gravity, but nonetheless, it is self-contained. I mean, it's consistent within the hypothesis. But I think there are two hypotheses which I sort of feel are rather very questionable, and so I just wanted to get your viewpoint on that. The first is about the one is looking at modifications of the Hamiltonian constraints, keeping the phase space the same. Now, almost every modification that people write down involves higher derivative curvature terms, which changes the phase space. And so it's a very strong hypothesis to make, I mean, that the phase space doesn't change at all. And the second thing is that we have this, you know, beautiful theorems due to Heumann, Kukash, and Teitelbaum, which told us that if, in fact, the constraint algebra has this kind of modification of the type that you said, and you had a transparency about that, then we do not have space-time covariance, so there will not be a space-time metric, really. I mean, you can choose one slicing and get a description, and somebody else will choose some other slicing, and they'll get some other description, and there is no space-time covariance. And therefore, if there is no space-time metric, really, at a fundamental level, to talk about signatures change within the model also doesn't make sense. So to me, these two things, attractive as the idea seems, these two are, to me, are major obstacles. And I just wanted to have your comments on that.
No, okay. So thank you for raising the point. In fact, I will not answer clearly, because we are right now working with Martin on this. And I think I would really try to advocate a very honest way. At this stage, I am not completely convinced that those arguments make this approach inconsistent, because I think that some of the hypotheses of those behind those statements are probably not fulfilled in this approach. However, I don't want to push this too far. If it happens to be inconsistent, I would have absolutely no problem stopping doing this and switching to something else. So at this stage, I don't know. I've read your criticisms. I think they have to be taken into account. I'm not yet sure that they completely disprove this kind of approach. This is under study. I mean, we are working on these criticisms, and it might be that they are correct. Yes. No, but I mean, okay, thank you for raising this point, and this is under study. So I think in the next month, we'll be able to come back to this. Just a little point about the change of signature of the metric. Some people also don't like it because it appears only for perturbations, but I would just like to say that anyway, for the homogeneous universe, the associated Poisson bracket is automatically vanishing. So it's normal that we see it only with perturbations, because with the background, we cannot see it anyway. So it cannot show up somewhere else than in perturbations. So this, in my opinion, is not a weakness.
Okay, let's thank Aurélien again, and we reconvene at 11, so make it quick.